Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
A new lawsuit is challenging New York's medical aid in dying law before it takes effect in August. New York Public News Network reporters Jimmy Vielkind and Samuel King recently sat down to talk about the suit and other news from the Capitol.
Hi, Samuel.
Hi, Jimmy.
Samuel, you reported on some last-minute legal challenges to New York's medical aid in dying law. What are they all about?
Well, the latest suit is from a coalition of Catholic health providers, nursing homes, and nuns, as well as the Diocese of Rockville Center on Long Island. They say even though religious organizations can opt out of medical aid in dying, they would still have to advise patients of their options. Attorneys argue that violates their First Amendment rights. Here's Adele Keim, a senior counsel with the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, the attorneys for the plaintiffs.
Consistent with the Constitution, the best of our traditions, the government cannot go in and tell people how to die.
They're seeking a temporary injunction to keep the law from taking effect on August 5th. A judge rejected a similar request from a group of disability rights groups. Their lawsuit, though, is still pending.
So this means that the law is going to take effect.
The governor's office tells me it's full speed ahead, Jimmy, and the Department of Health is working to implement the law, quote, thoroughly and responsibly. Veronica Darling is the director of litigation for the nonprofit Compassion and Choices. The group lobbied heavily for Governor Hochul to sign the aid in dying legislation, and she says the state's response is a relief.
It means they can focus on living their lives and spending time with their family and not worrying about having to rework their end of life plan.
Okay, we'll see if any judges act in these final days.
And Jimmy, you were recently at a rally for Governor Hochul, and it made you wonder just how powerful organized labor is right now.
Yeah, that's right. I visited a union hall for something that was put on by the state Democratic Party. Hochul allies bashed her Republican opponent, Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, and two of the speakers were labor leaders. But I was thinking about recent losses by labor-backed candidates in New York City, and even how a lot of union members have supported President Trump, even though their leaders have endorsed Democratic candidates.
Yeah, both Adriano Espaillat and Antonio Reynoso lost Democratic primaries this year to candidates backed by the Democratic Socialists of America. That group is showing a lot of organizing might.
That's how I posed the question to Mark Emanation. He's the Capital District Area Labor Federation's executive director. He says he knows that union members cross the political spectrum.
So what we want to do this year is to go talk to them at their doors and say, how's life treating you? What do you think we should do collectively to make this thing change?
Are Democrats worried?
They say no. Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, after all, won his statewide primary very easily with lots of labor support. And a spokesperson for Hochul's campaign says she's feeling confident.
There's news from the Garden State about voter fraud. New Jersey officials say a software glitch by an outside vendor led to around 400 non-citizens voting in the 2024 elections. The firm in question, Edemia, also has business in New York, Jimmy.
Republicans in the state legislature saw that, and they're calling for a hearing to examine the state's voter registration infrastructure. They note that the Department of Motor Vehicles in New York has Edemia contracts for software that lets people apply for driver's licenses and register themselves to vote at the same time. Assemblymember Matt Slater is a Westchester County Republican. He says he was surprised by the news from New Jersey.
I think that should give us reason to pause and reevaluate and recalibrate.
Is there any evidence of problems?
So far, no. The State Board of Elections says it has a different registration process than New Jersey. Applicants have to affirm multiple times that they're citizens in order to register to vote. And Democrats who control the State Assembly haven't answered Slater's request for a hearing.
Okay, we'll see if that story has any legs. Talk soon, Jimmy.
Take care, Samuel.
That's New York Public News Network reporters Jimmy Vielkind and Samuel King. The largest utility-scale solar facility in the Catskills and Hudson Valley could be coming to Sullivan County. More from the New York Public News Network's Kimberly Izar.
The solar developer RWE filed its application on Monday with New York's Office of Renewable Energy Siting and Electric Transmission, or ORES, to build a 200 megawatt solar and 100 megawatt battery energy facility in Sullivan County. The facility would be located in the towns of Thompson and Forestburg and span more than 1,200 acres. If built, it would be the largest solar facility in the Catskills and Hudson Valley. But some residents and local officials have flagged environmental and ethical concerns with the project. One of the project's property owners who would lease land to RWE is Walter Grigliano, who serves as Sullivan County IDA's attorney. Grigliano told Radio Catskill in an email that he would not be involved in representing or advising the IDA if the developer approached the agency. Others have raised environmental concerns about wildlife displacement, wetland threats, and overall project noise. Christopher Titus, a local biologist in Monticello, pushed back against the project at a Town of Forestburg meeting in June.
My goal is not to oppose renewable energy, rather to ensure that any project at this scale is thoroughly reviewed, environmentally responsible, and accountable to the community that we live in with its impacts for decades to come. A large-scale solar facility in the middle of an old-growth forest is not the right move.
The project area includes 133 wetlands, 9 ponds, 27 vernal pools, and 83 stream segments, according to application documents. Pat McClellan, policy director of the New York League of Conservation Voters, says that New York will need more renewable energy to add to the state's aging electric grid.
As demand for electricity continues to grow, you know, as people switch to electric cars from ones that run on gasoline or diesel, as buildings switch to electric heating and cooling from, you know, natural gas or heating oil, those add more demand for electricity to the grid.
And to meet state mandates. New York has a goal of reducing emissions to 60% of 1990 levels by 2040. The former mandate of 100% zero emission energy was amended in this year's state budget. ORIS has 60 days to respond to whether or not RWE submitted a complete application. After the application is marked complete, ORIS has 12 months to approve or deny a siting permit to the developer. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Dan Clark from the Times Union's Capital Confidential newsletter. We began by discussing who donates the most to state legislators' campaigns.
Healthcare groups love to give to the state legislature. They love to give to whoever's really in power in the state legislature.
Right.
Right now, that's Democrats, and probably for the foreseeable future, that's Democrats in both the state Senate and the Assembly. So you have groups like the Greater New York Hospital Association, big labor unions, 1199 SEIU, which represents a lot of healthcare workers. They've always been big supporters of Democrats in the state legislature. They want them to stay there and keep doing what they're doing, especially in the past few years with Governor Hochul. They have secured, they meaning lawmakers and the governor, have secured higher Medicaid rates for healthcare institutions. That's huge because New York State has historically, at least over the past decade, only reimbursed these healthcare providers about 70% of what they say is the cost to provide these services. So every little bump that they can give benefits those healthcare institutions. And then the thought is, at least from the union perspective, that money then trickles down to their workers in the form of higher pay and benefits.
And what kind of money are we talking here, Dan?
Well, we're talking millions of dollars. It depends on the lawmakers and how the money's distributed. Of course, a lot of these specialty trade organizations and influential groups will donate to these campaign accounts that are held by each political party in the legislature instead of to one single legislature or legislator, I should say. Although you will see them donate to individual lawmakers, it's more popular to go into those campaign accounts and then For example, the Democratic Assembly Campaign Committee will choose how they want to distribute that money. These healthcare groups may not know, for example, some polling that's done behind the scenes that shows certain members in areas of the state that are more competitive than other members. So they leave it up to the lawmakers. As long as they know that the conference is supported by those healthcare institutions, that's what matters.
Now, Dan, I know you know this, but I want to ask the question, are we naive or are we savvy? I'm talking about the people who get cynical about this stuff. They say, we know that when you put millions of dollars in the campaign coffers of legislators, there's more likely the idea that you're going to get what you want. And yet these claims to the contrary. I'm responding to my constituents and what my constituents want. The money, I hate raising money, you'll hear politicians say. It's not part of the job I like. I don't like that. I want to serve the people. Which is it?
I think it's a chicken and the egg situation when it comes to campaign contributions. I think that when you look at a entity giving to lawmakers, you could look at it as they're trying to influence lawmakers to do something in the future. There's a specific issue on the table that they're trying to suggestively say to a lawmaker, I will pad your campaign coffers if you vote this way on a certain issue or advocate this certain way. Now, there's the other side of the coin that is, I would say, less nefarious, where maybe a group is saying, hey, you voted for this last year. We really liked that. Thank you so much for doing that. We're going to give you money because we want you to stay in your seat and not be defeated by somebody who may then vote against our interests. So I think that if you asked a lot of these groups which of those two camps they fall into, they're saying, thank you so much for doing that. But I think realistically, the cynic in me says that a lot of them are trying to say, in the future, please side with us.
Yeah, I think that's right. And at the very least, I think if you look at the goo-goo groups, the groups that don't have the money and the power, they have to use the public airwaves and campaigns to get their message out. But it doesn't mean also a group like Compassion and Choices, which worked for 10 years to try to get the medical aid and dying law passed, won't have success. So you're pointing out that yes, there's a cynical part of this, but there's also good public policy, public support for that good public policy, and a legislator and legislators that will respond when they put their finger up to the wind and say, hey, the people are going this way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you have to go down the trail a little bit to determine how you're going to feel about these kind of campaign contributions. Do you support a hospital taking money out of its coffers to fill a trade group's coffers that will then try to influence policy at the state level? That's for you as a voter, for a patient to decide if you want to support something like that. Of course, you don't have a choice in the matter. You're paying the healthcare institution and they're using your money how they see fit. But those are the kind of conversations that I think a lot of people have around ethics and campaigns. We have a lot of ethical loopholes in New York State. Just one, for example, lobbyists have to report to the state, for example, what bills that they lobby on behalf of their clients. They do not have to report what position their clients have on something. So if I represent Coca-Cola and I'm lobbying on this big bill on, I don't know, packaging or sugar content in food or something like that, I'm going to assume as a consumer probably that company is against that. But that company does not have to say that. And could you imagine the surprise if they supported it?
Is this accidentally on purpose?
That's one of those things. Is it's been pointed out by good government groups along several different years. And lawmakers have not so far gotten anything into law that would change that.
It seems to me that because of so many of these ethical loopholes, the lawmakers are in danger of hoisting themselves on their own petard. So they put these vagaries in the language to create a deniability.
That's exactly it, right? If I was a lawmaker and I got thousands of dollars from my party's campaign account, but my party took thousands of dollars from Coca-Cola, right now, there's no way for the public to know definitively what legislation Coca-Cola opposes or supports. If we change that, maybe we could draw a more direct line between how Coca-Cola, for example, is trying to influence a specific lawmaker through those campaign contributions.
We're speaking with Dan Clark of the well-known Capital Confidential at the Times Union, timesunion.com, to find out more. Now, here in your Capital Confidential, in bills passed but pending, Hochul will soon have to decide if people who work or volunteer with children in certain contexts have to be screened against sex offender registries. That's currently not required in many instances. Huh?
Yeah, that's true. there are these extracurricular programs that you may enroll a child in. Think of sporting leagues. This isn't your after-school school sports team. This is an extracurricular third-party sport or recreational center, something like that. They are not required by law to screen their employees for sex offenses. So this bill, what it would do is just enact that requirement. And it would say if somebody's moving from out of state, for example, that the state would or the entity would have to screen where they lived as well. So it extends protections that are already in place for the vast majority of places where children might find themselves.
That's Dan Clark from the Times Union's Capital Confidential newsletter. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Food insecurity is leaving many North Country families in a pinch. Since June, changes to SNAP, the federal food assistance program, is expected to cut tens of thousands of people from their benefits. Food banks and social service providers are working to provide a safety net. The New York Public News Network's Richard Haller visited a food pantry recently in Watertown, where the need has increased sharply.
A man is rolling a shopping cart stocked with food. His wife holds their two-month-old daughter.
I'm active duty military. My wife and I just had a baby. We're on a single income, which is mine. And we've been having a hard time with just keeping up with the food on top of all the other bills.
That's Donato Negro. He's based at Fort Drum. He says they've been struggling with high electric bills and the cost of heating in the winter. This is their first time getting help from Urban Mission in Watertown, the biggest food pantry in Jefferson County.
We just need like staples, you know, like some flour, sugar, eggs, milk, stuff like that, butter, you know, the basics, basically bread.
The place feels more like an Aldi's or discount grocery store than your typical food pantry.
So we've kind of, we've kind of made it like a grocery store. We want people to feel more comfortable coming in.
Shelves are stocked with canned goods, fruits and vegetables, and there's plenty of refrigeration. Hillary Collins, the receptionist, shows me around the spacious, air-conditioned room.
We used to do boxes next door, but now we encourage everybody to bring their own bags, so it feels more of like a market experience.
Across the country, people have been struggling with the cost of basic living expenses like groceries and gas and utilities. Collins says they've seen a significant uptick in families coming for help who didn't have to before.
Definitely probably by 20 or 30% people that are losing their food stamps or they have to work now for their, you know, for their benefits. Yep. And we've had an uptick in volunteers as well.
The Trump administration's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act cut SNAP, previously known as food stamps, by more than $200 billion over the next decade. Since June, more people need to work to keep their SNAP benefits, including unhoused people. The Regional Food Bank, based in Albany, provides a large network of food pantries, soup kitchens, and other nonprofits with a steady supply of food assistance across 20 counties, including much of the North Country region. Sue Littner is the vice president. She says food demand has increased by 14% across all of these counties over the last year.
There are higher costs of food, higher costs of utilities, higher costs of transportation, and so many individuals in our service area are losing access to benefits like SNAP assistance at this point that it's just a little bit of a perfect storm. So our food pantries are just seeing this unprecedented demand at this point.
Littner says the Regional Food Bank is expecting 60,000 people to lose their SNAP benefits in their service area. The SNAP cuts are expected to affect all New Yorkers. The federal government is passing down some costs to states. New York taxpayers could pay $160 million more. Littner says counties will also have to pay a share of that cost.
And that's really the next step in why this is so frightening. Our counties really don't have the funds to close this equation and pay for these benefits that had previously been paid for at the federal level.
Urban Mission's Director of Client Services, Amy Klemgard, says they've seen 600 more families coming for help in the last year.
and people are having to choose between eating and paying their electricity bill so it doesn't get shut off. So we're seeing a lot more people who are working families who just can't afford groceries and electricity and gas coming in to get some help with food.
Okay, so what do you got for us?
I got like 5 or 6 boxes.
Oh, wow.
Urban Mission in Watertown is more than a food pantry. It's a whole nonprofit facility. Homeless people are hanging out inside to escape the heat, and volunteers are getting in their hours for SNAP work requirements. In the basement, there's a huge storage area. A shipping truck backs up in front of the sliding doors. Doug Getman is the maintenance truck driver who delivers food and anything else. He says he feels lucky that he gets to help people with his job.
That's one of the best feelings, is when somebody stumbles in and needs something and we actually have what they need so we can help them.
Joe Johnson helps manage the place. He gives me a big smile when saying why he does what he does.
It makes them happy and it makes us smile when we see them happy. It's the best feeling in the world when you know you're helping somebody and they say thank you.
Yeah, especially in this world because that's pretty rough out there right now, so...
They both agreed that more people need help right now, whether that's getting some clothes, a place to stay, or a meal for the day. Sue Littner from the Regional Food Bank says that food pantries are a lifeline for people. She says if they didn't exist, entire families would be going without food on the table. In Watertown, I'm Richard Haller for the New York Public News Network.
Students from across Sullivan County recently went to a different kind of school where police, firefighters, and paramedics were their teachers. 23 high schoolers, all 14 to 16 years old, spent the week with first responders at the county's third annual Emergency Services Youth Academy. The New York Public News Network's Elias Guerra with more.
We did fire stuff, I think, the other day with that stuff. Yesterday we did the canine stuff, like bombs with the bomb squad. They showed us the robot that they bring to get the bomb and bring it back, and they explode it themselves. The way that they want to and not how they, how the people who said the bombs want to. And we got to meet the canine dog unit, and that was super fun.
That was Alyssa McLeod, who said her father is second assistant chief at the Jeffersonville Fire Department. She plans to join him when she turns 16. Jake Zenas says cadets there can start at 16 years old and can learn a lot.
They go to calls, they watch... They watch the rest of the firefighters work. There are classes that they can also take. There's in-house training that they can take. As long as they show up to drills, work nights, and stuff like that, firefighters more than happy to show them anything they want to know.
James Sherwood, 15 years old, is already a cadet at the Livingston Manor Fire Department. He's not old enough to go out on calls, but he still helps out.
But it's still a lot of fun. We get to sit there. We can clean the rigs. We get to go out on drill.
He said cadets even go to live fire sometimes as long as they stay at a safe distance.
Well, like this one drill that we went on, we were doing a controlled burn of a condemned house, and we were just... Of course, we aren't allowed to do anything, so we had to watch from a safe distance, but we were still able to sit there and gain the experience of, like, watching how some things are handled.
Other students, like Makai Squire, said he's been looking for cadet programs across the Catskills and Hudson Valley.
What do you like the idea of being a firefighter?
Saving people and putting out fires, because something not everybody wants to do because it's a dangerous job.
Young people who want to join emergency services couldn't be doing so at a better time. John D'Alessandro with the Fire Association of the State of New York says that 80% to 85% of fire and emergency response in New York State is done by volunteers, and he said it's getting harder to recruit young people.
In the early 2000s, there were about 120,000 volunteers across the state. We estimate that we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 80,000 today. And that's because of a lot of different reasons. You know, society has changed. People's attitudes have changed. Young people are much more mobile. You know, they leave the communities they grew up in more often these days for a job or a significant other or to go away to school. So the challenge that we've been facing for the last 15 or so years is this sort of, you know, steady decline in the number of volunteers around the state.
D'Alessandro said it's an easier problem to identify than it is to fix. He said recent campaigns to get new members have worked to stop the decline. But the problem is acute in rural areas of New York. Tony Carlucci is the captain of Bethel Emergency Medical Services. He works there full time, but says the rest of Bethel EMS is all volunteer. Carlucci said it's even harder for EMS to recruit because people are always getting sick, which leads to burnout for volunteers.
It's a lot for a volunteer to do. Between responding from your house, getting your ambulance, and meeting on scene, assessing the patient, putting them in the ambulance, and then transporting whether to Harris or Orange, and then you have the offload time, and then you got to come back, a call could be 2-3 hours long, depending on where you're going.
Carlucci said they also struggle with retention, especially as more people move into the area. D'Alessandro said incentives like tax credits for volunteers have not increased in 2 decades. Recent state legislation would raise the tax credits for volunteer firefighters and ambulance crews from $200 to $800 and awaits the governor's decision. For Alyssa McLeod, being a firefighter is something of a calling.
They just help out, and my dad does it. He risks his life like every single time he goes on a call, and I just want to do it.
You're not worried about the danger at all?
I am, but it's also about helping other people.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Elias Guerra.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. Listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org. Look for program number 2632. And join us again next week at this same time. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.